This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Observing a national day of mourning after Wednesday's terror attack in the southern city of Kerman that killed nearly 100 people. Iranian officials vow a strong response to perpetrators and masterminds of the terror bombings in Kerman amid global condemnations of the attack. And also, the death toll from Israeli genocide in Gaza exceeds 22,300 as refugee camps and healthcare sector remain the main targets of the regime's strikes. Our top story for this half hour, Iran is observing a national day of mourning after Wednesday's deadly terror attack targeting civilians in the southern city of Kerman. Twin blasts killed 84 Iranians and injured over 200 others at a ceremony marking the fourth assassination anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. According to the Interior Minister, the two explosions occurred minutes apart at two different locations, crowded with people. Ahmad Vaidi said the bombs contained shrapnel that caused the extreme amount of casualties hours after the attack. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution vowed a strong response to both perpetrators and masterminds of the terror bombings in a message. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the callous criminals could not tolerate the people's love and enthusiasm for visiting the resting place of their great commander, martyr Soleimani. President Ibrahim Raisi has also vowed that the perpetrators will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
These gatherings that you see held in the country, this flood of people that poured towards the grave of Haj Qasem these days, you come to scare the people within your criminal act. You're not strong enough to face the resistance. Your power has lost its effectiveness against the forces of resistance. Now you're targeting innocent people? Know that you will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
The Iranian president was addressing a ceremony marking the assassination anniversary of General Soleimani. Raisi also talked to Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. On the phone, he said Zionists who are facing global condemnations over their ruthless massacre of Palestinians are now trying to spread insecurity to other parts of the region. Editor-in-chief of Basira Press, Ali Salam, joins us now from the city of Kerman to offer some more insight on the situation that's taking place. Mr. Salam, welcome to the program. Up until now, no one has claimed responsibility for this reprehensible attack, but we must try to deduce and think that who would benefit from such an ugly attack, and who benefits from such instances of insecurity in the region.
First, inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi rajiun. From God we come, and to Him shall we return. I wish all blessings and patience and mercy upon the families of the martyrs. Actually, I was taking a flight here yesterday. By the time we got to the passengers were getting to the steps of the stairs of the airplane, some people started to talk about bombs, and the guy next to me showed the video. And that's when we found out, basically when we were just about to board to get on, some people may be going to their homes, but in my case, I was coming to directly pay respects to the commander of the hearts of the free peoples of the world. martyr Qasem Soleimani, rahmatullah alayh, and it was a very big tragedy. And the numbers went up by the time that we landed, and it became an even bigger tragedy that struck the hearts of many. And this is a city and a region, as well as a nation, and hopefully a world in mourning. And to answer your question directly, who would benefit from this? Well, let's look at who is going out of their way, like desperately, to try to deny their involvement. It's the Americans and the Zionists who are issuing all kinds of press statements. No, we didn't do it. It's like when you go into a room and there's like the special cookie jar that you're saving for guests, and you see some kid, he has his hand in it and he has his mouth full, he has crumbs all over his face. He looks both ways and he points maybe at his younger brother or something like that. Well, in this case, their younger brother might perhaps be ISIS, or it might be the Munafiqeen al-Khalq, the hypocrite terrorist organization known as MEK. It could be any one of their proxies, but they're just different flavors of the same thing, and they work for the same master at the end of the day. Perhaps it might be ISIS because this region is close to Sistan and Balochistan, which is the hotbed for Mossad and CIA-backed Takfiri terrorists such as ISIS and the Ajundala, or whatever their name is. Maybe they're defunct now, that their leader was captured many years ago. But it's without a doubt that it's the United States and Israel. If they weren't guilty, they wouldn't be going out of their way to prove how not guilty they are for this immense tragedy. And they've spilled the blood of, what is the count, is above 100 or close to 200 now, according to some estimates. Where are their crocodile tears? These same people who claim to care so much about the Iranian people when it comes to wearing a piece of cloth over a woman's head to showcase her dignity and not reduce herself to a sexual object in the eyes of the in the public space, at least, not in the private space. They don't care when the blood of innocent Iranians, including women and children, is spilled. So these great hypocrites must pay for their crimes. And we don't even, at this point in time, we need to just basically assume that it's a Mossad or CIA attack, or, you know, one of these types of things, because that's just how they operate. And in regards to attacks that have happened in the past, we find out about their involvement years later when the papers are revealed. So it's pretty obvious who the killers are.
And Mr. Salam, before we leave you, I also want to get your perspective on the issue of the motives of targeting this specific day and this specific ceremony as well, which had commenced to celebrate, commemorate, and also mourn all in one what the anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani stood for, and also denouncing his assassination at the hands of the United States. So tell us more about this specific day and this specific ceremony being targeted in the manner that it was.
This is an attempt to kill the unbreakable spirit of the Iranian people, but it is obviously, there's no need to equivocate. It has completely failed. The blood of these martyrs has woken people up even more, and the spirit of this very pious and righteous man who, as we know, had saved Christians and Muslims in Syria and Iraq from the Mossad and CIA-backed proxy terrorist group known as ISIS. Anybody who pretends to care about Christians in the West, who says, oh, Muslims bad, you know, demonizes Muslims all day, where are they to thank Hezbollah and martyr Qasem Soleimani and the Syrian Arab Army and Iran and Russia for defeating ISIS? They're nowhere to be found. And in fact, they're encouraging their own governments to support these very terrorists that they claim to be against. So these types of things, whoever is against Qasem Soleimani, it exposes their hypocrisy. This is also the price that Iran pays for standing with the people of Palestine. It shows that the Iranian people are not more superior than the people of Gaza to not endure the same pain for standing for the truth, for standing for righteousness, and to stand against the real acts of terrorism. And so this will hopefully increase a greater link solidarity and love between the Iranian and Palestinian peoples. And we should, I would feel ashamed if I go now to the grave of martyr Qasem Soleimani and not mention the true nature of this Zionist regime and what we're dealing with, because today also in the news, the Epstein flight logs were released. So it's not just that we see the Zionist regime openly killing children across the world. Now we know, because Jeffrey Epstein was an agent of the Israeli Mossad who basically used a pedophilia honey trap to get all these politicians to support Israel blindly, in the West at least. that it's also a child molesting regime. So they kill children on the one hand and they molest children on the other hand. This is a wicked regime. How can they claim to be the chosen people of God? How can the Westerners who support this regime claim that they have any kind of moral high ground? The moral high ground is here. It is at the grave of martyr Qasem Soleimani. And anybody who has a heart, anybody who has any humanity, anybody who believes in God will support and take martyr Qasem Soleimani as a role model and a hero and abandon the child killing and child molesting Zionist regime. And the world is waking up, and eventually the tsunami of the blood of martyr Qasem Soleimani will crush the wicked palaces of the tyrants once and for all, God willing.
All right, thanks a lot, sir. Editor-in-Chief of Basir Press, Ali Salam, joining us from Kerman. We're now going to cross over to our correspondent, Mahdi Abbasian, who's joining us now from outside the Shahid Bahonar Hospital.
Mahdi, as you said, we are right now at Bahonar Hospital, one of the three main hospitals in Kerman, in which the people who got injured during yesterday's terror attack are hospitalized. Today, we had a chance to talk to Iran's health minister and also the officials of this hospital, the manager of this hospital, about the people who have been hospitalized here. You know, the casualties are mainly divided into two groups. The first group are those who have been affected by the shrapnel. Many of them have been seriously injured due to the small pieces of metal that have penetrated through their bodies. And the other group are those who are affected by the shock, and also due to the, because yesterday the place and the area in which the blast took place was packed with people. Many people panicked, and some of them, you know, got stuck under, you know, there was a stampede. And the other group that are, you know, hospitalized in the medical centers are this group. Now, talking to health officials, they said that mostly the casualties, the injured people, are in good condition, and there is no need to worry. Many of them have been released from hospital. And however, around 20 people are unfortunately hospitalized in the ICU ward. We had a chance to go there and see them. Unfortunately, some of them were kids as young as 4. They were unconscious, and also there were young teenagers who were badly wounded by the shrapnel. Some of them, as I talked to the doctors, they said that we are doing our best so that they can be fine. However, the chances are not much for them to survive. Also, the other thing that I have to add is that Iran's health minister told us that yesterday a group of surgeons, nearly 20 surgeons, have traveled to the city of Kerman in order to perform surgeries on the patients that are here. Many of the patients that are hospitalized here still need several other surgeries to get the shrapnels out of their bodies, or surgeries on, you know, other parts of their body, their organs that are badly injured during the blasts. The latest updates that we have is that the number of total deaths is 84. Until last night, there were many people standing behind the doors of the hospitals waiting for the names of their loved ones to be read, because they wanted to know if they are hospitalized here. Some of the victims, unfortunately, due to the blast, they were not able to identify them, and they were unrecognizable. And because of this, some of them are still unknown. Their family members, their loved ones, are still waiting to see if their loved ones are still alive or not. And despite all this, still today, people continued participating in the martyrdom ceremony, you know, memorial ceremony for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in Kerman, and they flocked to Kerman's Martyrs Cemetery to pay tribute to the late general. And this shows that despite this heinous crime, despite the fear the terrorists and groups responsible for this heinous, you know, crime.
All right, thanks a lot, Matt Yabosyan, joining us from Kerman. I'm also very glad that you're safe because you were extremely close to the area where the explosions happened. Iran is observing a national day of mourning after Wednesday's deadly terror attack targeting civilians in the southern city of Kerman. A rally is taking place right now, yet again in condemnation of the terror attacks in Kerman. The twin blasts killed 84 Iranians. Unfortunately, the death toll is expected to rise. Over 200 others were also injured. At a ceremony marking the fourth assassination anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Now, we were listening to the updates, latest updates from the city of Kerman outside one of the three main hospitals in the city by our correspondent, and also according to the Interior Minister, the two explosions occurred minutes apart at two different locations that were packed with people who were participating in the ceremony marking the assassination anniversary of General Soleimani. According to the Interior Minister himself, he said that the bombs contained shrapnel, which caused the extreme amount of casualties as well. And reactions also have been pouring in condemnation of this reprehensible and deplorable terrorist attack on innocent civilians. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files. But do you condemn Hamas? This has been mainstream media's favorite question ever since Hamas's preemptive strike on occupied Palestine on October the 7th. But sadly for them, they're no longer the only media that people get their news from. After some 75 years of the ongoing genocide in Palestine, the journalists on the ground were finally able to get their voice across to people all over the world and to inform them of the bombings that have killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. And that's when October 7th could no longer justify the ongoing genocide, even in the minds of former supporters of the Israeli regime. Now, many have already realized that mainstream media blamed Hamas to buy more time for the Zionist regime to murder as many Palestinians as they could and to occupy as much land as possible. But the question remains, from a legal perspective, who is responsible for the thousands of lives lost, especially since October the 7th? Hello, I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. This is the discussion that we will have today with lawyer and doctor of jurisprudence and human rights activist Stanley Cohen. Stay tuned, please.
Stanley Cohen is an American lawyer and human rights activist. Following graduation from college, Stanley started working as a Vista volunteer and helped set up legal service projects in Native American reservations. Cohen then went on to work as a community organizer to tackle the issues of homeless teens and later as an administrator in a federally funded anti-poverty agency. He then went on to law school to defend human rights on a legal level and earned a doctorate of jurisprudence. Since then, he has worked on various lawsuits, from those taking on the NSA spying program to others involving false accusations targeting various minorities and individuals. Defending Patrice Lumumba against accusations of the material support of terrorism, and defending the Hamas political leader against extradition by the Israeli regime. Due to his success in various such legal projects, Stanley Cohen has for long been a target for smearing campaigns and various threats, which he has survived to date.
Well, thank you so much, Stanley Cohen, for being with us. I'd like to start off with mainstream media's favorite question. Do you condemn Hamas? And what are the legal definitions of their actions according to law?
I like to respond to that question with, who did you pick on before Hamas from, 1936 to 1985? The mainstream media likes to use Hamas as the convenient boogeyman, likes to use any quote-unquote Islamist movement, even one that's overseeing, with all the difficulties, the civil society that was voted into office, but it's always Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. So they look to October 7th, and they completely ignore the history of Israeli genocide, Israeli ethnic cleansing, Israeli war crimes, Israeli crimes against humanity, and they say it's Hamas. Do I condemn Hamas? No. Hamas is a national liberation movement that has been in the forefront of the resistance since 1985. It has a leadership that is highly educated, sophisticated, learned, committed to their people from Gaza. These are not people that one day got on a plane and came from Brooklyn, as the Zionists are, to some foreign country. These are people that grew up in Gaza, many of whom the leadership left over a number of years to pursue education elsewhere, received doctorate degrees, they're academics, they're scholars, they're lawyers, they're scientists, they're producers, they're directors, they're artists, and returned home to help to liberate Palestine. So do I condemn Hamas? No.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, because you've represented many people who couldn't afford to pay you along the way. And I mean, given your expertise and your experience, you could have had a lot more money. Why did you choose a different path?
I recently had a discussion with a journalist who asked me the same question. I said, well, I'm sure Henry Kissinger did not get to take his money with him. I'm sure Bill Gates will not be able to take his money with him. We have to make choices in life. Is it about the pursuit of profit? Is it about the pursuit of power? Is it about political control? Or is it about being part of a world community that's here for a very limited period of time, since that they too were not going to spend their lives pursuing money, but pursuing justice?
Well, why did you, you've decided to represent a lot of Hamas officials and other groups too, although there would be repercussions for you? Why is that the case?
Well, I had, years before I represented Abu Marzouk, who was one of the founders of Hamas and was the original head of the political wing and is now still a major senior leader of the movement, I had been involved in supporting Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian independence, Palestinian liberation as a young lawyer. I organized some political actions. I was involved as an attorney representing people that were protesting against Israel years before even Hamas evolved. I had a very active role in a Muslim in the Islamic community in the United States, not trying to singularize it, because obviously it's a community of diversity with different priorities. In fact, through my work representing many dozens of Albanian Muslims who were charged with various situations in the United States, and who eventually, as a result of negotiations, went to Bosnia and joined the KLA with the approval of the United States, in essence fighting before the United States dragged NATO in, before the bombings occurred. That connected me in a different light to the Muslim community in the United States in general and to the Palestinian community in particular. And then one day when I had just finished a very long trial and was getting ready to go on holiday for a few weeks, I got a call from the leaders of one of these organizations who asked me if I could go to the federal prison, that there was a gentleman who had been picked up suddenly on an immigration hold, someone who was a lawful resident in the United States. And I really was too tired and I couldn't do it. And I recommended other lawyers. And then as an aside, I said, well, who is this person? And then he mentioned a name to me, and the name didn't mean anything to me at the time. And he said, Musa Abu Marzouk. And I said, who was that? And then he said, well, I said, no, I'm tired. I need to get away. I've got family and friends that are expecting me. We've got a cabin on the ocean. And then he said, well, he's the head of Hamas. And I went, oh, okay. So I called my family and I said, look, you're going to have to do what you have to do on your own. I've got to go see this gentleman. And I went to meet Abu Marzouk. We spent a day or half a day talking. And I'll never forget, he looked at me when I walked in and he said, looked up and down at me, up and down. I had, my hair was all over the place and I had ripped dungarees on and I had a sweatshirt on that said, the first thing we do, quoting Shakespeare, we'll kill all the lawyers. And he looked at me and he said, who are you? And I told him, I used a certain term that I'd, a phrase that I'd been told to use to give him comfort that I wasn't there as a representative of the government. I'd been sent friends. And I used it. And he said, well, who are you? As he stared at me up and down, amazed, and he looked at me. And I said, well, I'm a lawyer. And he looked at me up and down. And he said, you're a lawyer? He said, I don't need a lawyer. And I said, you're right. You don't need one lawyer. You need a dozen lawyers. And he laughed. And he said, sit down. And I did. And that was the beginning of probably 1,000 hours with the one-on-one discussions that he and I had over the next 2 years. While we fought his case initially, it was for a removal order from the United States, and then the Knesset, an unprecedented act, issued an arrest warrant and demanded his extradition to Israel to stand trial for the Intifada. We became very close over the course of 2 years. And Abu Marzouk is not just a founder, a framer, and the original head of the political wing of Hamas. He's a brilliant political scientist. He's a brilliant internationalist. He's a travel gentleman who has, and still does, obviously, tremendous experience in politics and reality and history. He understands.
Wow, it's quite interesting, quite beautiful. I want to look at, if you give me permission, ask you a question about your Twitter account, or X, because you have a profile picture of two Hamas leaders there. I'd like to know why you have chosen that picture for your profile picture.
Sheikh Ahmed was a friend. I had the privilege and the pleasure of spending time with him, being hosted by him in Gaza on 5 or 6 occasions before he was assassinated. Abu Shanab was a dear friend. I spent a lot of time with Abu Shanab. In fact, the car in which he was assassinated was by an Israeli rocket. I had been in that car just 4 or 5 days before he had been murdered, going to an interview. And to show you the kindness, the support, the love of the Palestinian community in general in my relationship with it, I had left Gaza. I was handling a case in California. I figured it was early in the morning. I was asleep and my phone rang. And it was Abu Shanab's wife who told me she was giving me her condolences. She told me that Abu Shanab had been assassinated several hours before, and she wanted to give her condolences to me, his wife of decades, the mother of his children, because she knew how close we were. We were very close. Whenever I would go to Gaza, I would spend hours and days with Abu Shanab. He'd be my escort. He was a professor of engineering at the Islamic University in Gaza. He was educated, got his PhD in the United States. He was very close friends with Abu Marzouk. We hit it off right away. And I could think of no better way of honoring the memory of these two great warriors, these two wonderful, dynamic, principled fighters for justice and human rights.
Well, there are those who talk about Hamas on October the 7th and the legality as we are in the middle of this Israeli genocide. I mean, I'd like to hear your perspective based on international law regarding both sides of this current situation.
Under international law, an occupying force, an occupying state is permitted to maintain the de minimis or the minimum amount of security apparatus until there's a resolution as to the occupation. And that may mean small military outposts. That may mean the presence of occupying military or security forces. It does not permit the introduction of, as they have here, some 800,000 largely European colonialist Jews into the West Bank. It does not permit the theft of land and the establishment of so-called settlements. It does not permit for the building of walls. It does not permit for the establishment of infrastructure, of economy, of an infrastructure, a system that is comparable basically to a city. It doesn't permit it. And what they do, Israel, again, in going one step further, they decided because it's quote-unquote a military zone, then people that have been in the military zone for for thousands of years, are not entitled to due process of the occupying state. They're not entitled to get access to Israeli courts. And as we've seen for years now, even those Israelis going through the Israeli court system are denied any real modicum of justice, due process, and equal protection with a system of government in which the Knesset can largely overrule what the court system wants to do. So what they've done is they've established this military system. It's staffed by military judges, by military security people out of uniform, are not civilians. Israeli police out of uniform are not civilians. Settlers that are carrying weapons are not civilians. Settler outposts that have heavy-duty weapons is not a civilian outpost. So there's that whole definition. But clearly, children, the elderly, the infirm are civilian under international law and should not be removed. But the problem that we is not knowing who did what, when, where, why, or how, with just competing narratives. But when we talk about competing narratives, there's no debate over what's going on in Gaza. There's no debate what's been going on in Palestine for 75, 80, 85 years, even before the United Nations crafted Israel. Response to that is, Israel, prove your case. The International Criminal Court ruled in 2021 that it has jurisdiction not just over Palestine because it's a signatory to the Rome Statute.
Well, I can't believe we're still watching this murder take place on a daily basis. What can be done to stop this genocide immediately, in your perspective?
The ICC has enough probable cause and has enough evidence to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and a dozen of his top advisors. That immediately limits their ability to travel. That immediately sends a message to people that want to come there to meet with them, conspire with them. That raises the accountability and the concern, because that really sends the message, okay, you are a suspected criminal. There is an arrest warrant for you. We're going to file it with Interpol. There is some standing for the notion that assets can be frozen, which Iran is well versed in, although it's been used of not legally against Iran over the years, but as a political weapon. Assets can be frozen. Organizations, private entities that are now providing money, that are now providing weapons, that are now providing technical support to the Israeli government are on notice that you are if you continue, you may yourselves be involved in criminal wrongdoing. The General Assembly can ask the ICJ for an immediate recommendation. There is universal jurisdiction in many countries in this world. Claims can be brought. They've been started already in South Africa, which is similar to the ICC to the extent that they have the power to issue arrest warrants based upon probable cause. Red notices are set with Interpol. In states themselves, for example, in the United States, there can be an effort, there should be, lobbying and political effort to impose the Arms Export Control Act, which would freeze funding and weapons for Israel. There are domestic jurisdiction issues where if I'm a Palestinian, and I have Palestinian-American or Palestinian who happens to be in the United States right now, who has family, businesses, homes, et cetera, that have been destroyed, who have been executed, that have been victimized by war crimes. They can attempt to bring domestic actions in domestic courts under U.S. law. There's an issue of what's called extraterritoriality, which has to do with the ability of U.S. courts to reach out for activity and conduct overseas directed at U.S. But keep in mind, the U.S. has had more than a few examples over the years of Palestinian American citizens, including famed journalists, that have been executed by Israel, and the Department of Justice has done nothing in the United States. So again, there's that double standard. So there is an ability to move the ICC to bring an advisory opinion action in the International Court of Jurisdiction of Justice, for universal jurisdictions to file arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other leaders of the military, to begin to identify businesses. And we know there have been lawsuits in the United States that have gone after tax-exempt organizations that provide money illegally, that are tax-exempt to so-called settlements in the occupied West Bank, in the Palestinian territories. So there is a combination of actions which can be brought domestically and internationally, which can be saying to Israel, enough. But at this point, there have been 20,000 Palestinians who have lost their lives, almost all of them civilians, 60% of them children. 75% of Gaza is in ruins. 1.5 million people have been displaced. No food, no water, no electricity, no medical attention. Who knows what viruses and illnesses and plagues are going to befall. But again, this is not inadvertent. This is a determined effort, a designed plan that Israel has been waiting to unleash, and it has.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable, mind-boggling what is taking place and how everyone is watching it. I mean, based on this international rules-based community that exists right now, do you think that this same community then will actually play a role in stopping this genocide?
I'm not waiting for the world community to all of a sudden grow principle of justice and independence and to move on behalf of a targeted people. If for that, you know, we will be generations away. But I am optimistic that the combination of movement at the ICC, movement at universal jurisdictions, but most important, millions of young, largely young women and men worldwide in the streets, demonstrating, the BDS movement expanding, Israeli military factories and plants that are providing information being demonstrated against, civil disobedience there. There have been acts of criminal mischief as well. So I think this combination, and keep in mind, I'm not naive. I don't believe that Biden or the West or anyone with this is going to step in, A, until after Israel has been able to accomplish the next step of its never-ending Nakba that it's designed to do. But I think they're reaching, and they're not going to step in out of principle or out of purpose or out of passion or out of love or out of humanity. But it's going to reach a point where politically it's boomeranging back against them, and that's when they're going to step in. But meanwhile, the fact that Netanyahu has been given a green light, I mean, now he's invading the South. They displaced 1.5 million people in the north and the center of Gaza and sent them down basically to the south. And now the tanks are rolling into the south, and there's no defense. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinians, civilians, again, being slaughtered every day. There are variables, and I'm not suggesting or proposing that Hezbollah or Syria or anyone else continue their involvement or expand it, but that's an issue. Using the old anecdote, the colloquialism, the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop, there's increasing tension and fighting going on with Hezbollah in the north. Syria is pushing back again. I suspect the West Bank is going to explode. The real issue is, I think there's going to come a point in time. Let us not forget, this is as much about Netanyahu trying to save himself from a judicial process that he's under indictment, I believe, in 2 or 3 cases, and the trials are beginning again. In Netanyahu's mind, as long as he can say, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, he's safe. In the minds of the Kahanists that now run the military, the industrial military complex, the security state, as long as they get to say, see what they did to us, the they, us, they're allowed to expand, they're allowed to justify increasing violence, expansion of so-called settlements. I don't know how it's going to play out at this point.
Right.
But one thing is for sure, that resolution, meanwhile, is thousands of Palestinian lives are being lost to the lust, the political lust, not just of Israel, but the proxy masters of the West that have been involved in this situation. And it's not just the West. I look at UAE, I look at Bahrain, I look at Saudi Arabia, I look at Morocco, I look at other Arab states or Gulf states that have been complicit throughout. I look at the fact that we had to beg Egypt to open Rafah even periodically for goods and services to come in. And meanwhile says, yes, we'll let Rafah should be open so that we can displace 1 million Palestinians. Egypt, you deal with it. Push them off into the Sinai. Let's send the Bedouin back to the desert. So we have complicity among certain states in the region. And then we have other states that have long supported Palestine. Iran is one. Doha, Qatar has been there. Algeria has been there. South Africa and African states have been there. So we've got this tension that's underway right now, and I'd like to be able to predict with some modicum of certainty how it's going to end up, but I really can't at this point.
Well, Stanley, I'd like to hear your final comments about the overall situation.
Is very clear on what's going on in Palestine. I think the world community, especially the young women and men of the world community, need to stay in the streets, need to demonstrate, need to engage in all sorts of activities against governments, need to make sure that the political leadership understand there's a price to pay for their blind, obedient support for Israeli genocide. I send my love and solidarity to the Palestinian people. They know they are loved. They know they have support. We will fight with them. We will work with them. We will struggle with them. We will never forget we are family.
Stanley Cohen, it's been a pleasure having you right here on Hidden Files. I'd like to welcome my colleague, Maryam Azadcher, to Hidden Files. She's going to bring us a little bit more information about other situations taking place since October the 7th. Well, Maryam, welcome to the Hidden Files team. It's a pleasure having you on board.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being part of this team.
Well, I'd like to look at, because outside of the Palestinian territories, there were other situations taking place that has had a big effect. Tell us about that.
Yes, of course. So now what happened is that in bombing Gaza indiscriminately, the Israeli regime didn't just destroy Palestinian homes, schools, and hospitals. It also destroyed the widely believed myth that the international law was created to defend the rights of oppressed nations, and therefore there's no need for armed resistance. Now, today, this law has no real legitimacy and power in the eyes of millions who have seen Palestinian parents pull out the bodies of their children from under the rubble in the deafening silence of the so-called international community.
It's often said that one man's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Well, in this case, one colonialist terrorist is a nation's resistance fighter, and this has held true throughout history, where indigenous peoples, like Palestinians, were invaded using lethal weapons, stripped of their lands, using legal weapons and documents, and portrayed as the perpetrators of using the weapon of media. But there's one thing these powers cannot win without your consent. And that is the control of your mind. So next time they ask you to condemn those fighting against colonial interests, Maybe let them know that you have read their history. Goodbye for me, Marzia Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. One of the keys of life is dealing with people, and it is a very important key of life. And we said when it comes to people, there are people who are close to us in terms of relation, like blood-related people. Sometimes we can live in a very, very big family, aka tribe. And we still have that in a lot of countries where the clan or the tribe themselves, they stay together in one group. And sometimes they go their way, but this family is a very big family in terms of branches. It branches itself out, so they populate. The Ahlbayt Salamullah Alayhim, they said, it doesn't matter how big your family gets, as long as you are related to them in the blood, there is a requirement on you to do Salatul Rahm, to connect with your kin. You can't say, well, he's my third, fourth, tenth cousin. I don't even know who he is. I've never met him, never seen him. Therefore, none of my problem, not my business. Islam says, no, don't do that. A hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. He said to one of his companions, Zayd al-Shaham, and this is basically for me and you. So the Imam is conveying this message to Zayd al-Shaham to give to us. He says, "Iqra ala man tara annahu yuti'uni minhum." He says, anyone that you see that claims to be a follower of mine, a one who is obedient to me, which meaning aka Shia, وَيَأْخُذْ بِقَوْلِي, and he takes my word as a word of the Imam. First, أُوصِيكُمْ بِتَقْوَى اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ. So this goes to everyone who is listening, to every Shi'i. The Imam is saying this to you as you hear me. First he says, fear Allah, have piety, have taqwa. That's the first thing. And then the Imam gives a number of instructions until he gets to this part. He says, سُلُّ عَشَائِرَكُمْ. When it comes to your tribes, connect with them. One, washhadu janaizahum. When it comes to their funerals, attend it. Wa'udu mardahum. When it comes to their sick, visit them. Wa'addu huquqahum. And give back their rights. And then the Imam alayhi salam continues and says, if you guys do this, qila hadha ja'fari. They will say, this person is a follower of Ja'far al-Sadiq. فَيُسَرُّنِي ذَلِكَ. And when I get to hear that, that someone is labeled Ja'fari for the right reason, that makes me happy. وَيُدْخُلُهُ عَلَيَّ مِنْهُ السُّرُورِ. And he brings happiness and joy to my heart. Now, the Imam alayhi salam, in this beautiful hadith, which is narrated in Al-Kafi al-Sharif, he's saying that when it comes to your tribe, when it comes to your kin, to your family, you have requirements. Maybe the requirements are not immediate, but there are general things that you should always keep. One is that you need to attend their majalis. Sometimes, you know, there's gatherings of this family in a place or what have you. I do understand that depending on the country you're in, the situation could change and differ. But generally speaking, if it's possible to gather, and there is like what we call these days reunions, attend that reunion. When one of them passes away, Show your support. Go to the funeral. Be present. Let them know that they have someone else in this family that they can count on. They can see new faces. Sometimes a lot of people, maybe they don't interact. But when there's a funeral, they show up and people say, oh, we forgot about Fulan. We've never seen him before. Oh, thank God he's here. It means he cares. It means he really wants to help. And when one of them gets sick, go see him. Maybe that person sick needs your help. And especially, he could be in need of your financial help. So the Al-Bayt, they say to us, connect with your kin. Don't abandon them. That's the key of life. Let us take a break and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life. And the key of life in terms of being nice and kind and connecting with our kin, the Ahlul Bayt also focus on the aunt herself. And the aunt, obviously, being the father's sister, holds a great, you know, position. So Imam Salamullahi Alayhi, he tells us a narration. He says, a man came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and said to him, I had a newborn daughter, and once she got old and she became of age, I dressed her up and I made her look good, and then I brought her to a hole and I basically buried her alive in it. And while she's, as I'm burying this poor child, she was calling me, saying to me, Dad, Dad, Dad. And the man said, oh, Messenger of Allah, what is the kufara? What do I have to recompensate? How much do I have to pay for the vicious act that I did? The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he said to him, Alaka ummun hayya? Do you have a mother that's alive? He said, no. Alaka khazun hayya? Do you have an aunt that's alive? He says, nah. He says, the Prophet says to him, if you want to get Allah to forgive you for what you did, go to your aunt, be nice to her, be kind to her, take care of her, because the aunt is in the position of a mother. She holds the position of a mother to a person. So my aunt, I have to look at her as a mother. And sometimes, actually, if not all the times, our aunts, the way they look at us in this regard too, that we are their children. And sometimes they might even love us and care for us more than our own mothers. So from this sad story of the person that comes to the Prophet with his daughter, he says to him, look, you've done a grave sin. You committed a heinous crime. You killed an innocent soul. And obviously, this was before Islam, where the Arabs used to bury their daughters alive. And, you know, the famous verse from the Quran, وَإِذَا الْمَوْءُودَةُ سُئِلَتْ بِأَيِّ ذَنْبٍ قُتِلَتْ, for what reason was this child killed? And so this used to be done in the Arabs. And some of those who lived close at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, they've done this atrocious act. And when Islam came and they learned, they were trying to seek means to get Allah to forgive them. And we've been told that the mother is the closest thing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That when a mother does a dua, her dua is always answered. If you want anything from Allah, you go through your mother. The nicer and the kinder you are to your mother, the more Allah will give you. So the Prophet said, find someone that represents her and get her to intercede for you to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. We'll be right back.